and welcome to the Roofers Project. I'm your host, Trevor Holland, and I will be joined very, very soon by my good friend, Christian Fletcher. And what a great podcast we have in store for you. Yes, we are doing the compulsory Christmas cash-in episode. But don't you worry, we're looking at the other side of Christmas. Forget your Christmas carols and your family-friendly cute animated movies. Stuff that. We are digging deep and finding some of the more alternative options available for you this Christmas. I won't give it all away, just let it unfold as it comes to you. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. Right, so trying to think of something gaming to talk about with regards to Christmas is a bit more difficult than it sounds. I know what you're thinking, there are quite a few Christmas things out there. Trouble is, most of it is like a Christmas-themed level or some tie-in to an existing game. I know that there's a plethora of mobile games out there right now that are getting Christmas content. That's not what I'm really after with this. I want to look for games specifically about Christmas to check out. Now, that is a real challenge, and I'm afraid we do have to reach a fair way back. Now, I did debate whether to include things like Christmas Lemmings, which is quite fun, but again, it's really just a reskin of an existing game just for the season. There's also quite famous a variation of Nights into Dreams, or the old Sega Saturn, which was also a Christmas version, but that was just like two levels. It was more like a glorified demo than a full-on game, so I've had to move them out of the way. What does that leave me with, I hear you ask? Well, after my exhaustive research, I think I've found maybe three worth mentioning. Even then, it's a little questionable. But here we go. This is what I've found, and you will probably need to play these via emulator. I'm pretty sure there's nothing available for modern systems. Rightio, let's get to it. First up, we have Santa's Christmas Caper. Now, this is from quite some time ago. We're talking pretty much 1990, and was on the Commodore 64. The premise of this one is that the elves drugged Santa by giving him a rather tainted pudding, meaning that he was too basically drunk to fly his sleigh. So it's up to you, player, to guide Santa's sleigh to safety. Along the way, though, you've got to dodge evil snowmen, penguins jumping around, there's candy falling from the sky, and also beach balls, which is quite interesting because it's all set in the snow. Essentially, there isn't much more to say. It's a side-scroller, you're dodging obstacles, and the whole idea is just to see how far you can get and how high a score you can get. Fun for a bit, but, you know, as a long-term thing, I don't think it would really hold many people's attention. If you want something a bit more involved, a few more challenges to have along the way, then one that you could actually have a serious look at is James Pond 2, codename Robocod. This saw James Pond, who is a secret agent fish, don a robotic suit, hence Robocod, and track down his arch nemesis, who, as it's turned out, has taken over the North Pole and has been turning Santa's elves and presents into bad guy henchman. And this one does actually have a bit of fun. I do remember playing this one on the old Sega Mega Drive. It's also available for Super Nintendo. I believe there was an Amiga version. It did get pretty wide release. And it is a very colourful platform game. As a bit of a twist, James Pond could actually extend his body up so you could stretch up to higher levels. And the difficulty varied quite remarkably. If you do play this game, though, when you first start, there's a little section with five objects. Now, I can't remember them off the top of my head, but if you go by the first letter of each name and pick them up in the order where it goes C-H-E-A-T, it actually gives you invulnerability for a fairly good chunk of the first section of the game to help you get a little bit further. All in all, this was actually quite a fun one, and it's worth visiting again. But really, when we're talking Christmas games, where are the ones that let you play as the Jolly Fat Man himself? Well, rest assured, I've saved that one for last. Again, also available in the Mega Drive Super Nintendo era, you had Days Before Christmas, which actually was a pretty solid title. So in this game, an evil snowman has captured all of Santa's elves and reindeer, and you as Santa must head out, get them back, and save Christmas. What you do? Well, Santa's magic power is he can actually turn the bad guys into presents, which he can then collect to get more power and help himself along. There's also a little trick where if you drink coffee of all things, you become the Anti-Claws, which makes you invulnerable, but you can't collect those presents, and your only option of attacking people is to hit them with your sack. I'm not kidding. Along the way, it's not all platforming style. You can also go through sleigh rides, there's boss fights. It's actually quite a fast-paced game. So there you go. Christmas games. If you're going to be really pedantic about it, there's not that many to choose from. But from them, there are some decent things to play. Hey, can you think of a solid Christmas title that I have missed? Let me know. I will give you all those contact details at the end of the podcast.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Now when December hits each year, some of us battle the crowds, the air conditioning, or eat themselves stupid. Now, like a pudding of mixed flavours, this period also dishes up the inevitable Christmas movie. A dubious movie genre that thankfully only passes our detection once a month per year, thank God. Now, quintessentially, It's a Wonderful Life, starring James Stewart from 1946, has become the Christmas movie staple. But to be honest, I've just found that because copyright on the movie lapsed in the 70s, it made it prime and cheap fodder for television stations, so they would screen the movie every Christmas. So annual reruns meant people warmed to the story of George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart. But it's interesting, if you look at it a little bit more closely, it's actually a movie that's essentially about attempted suicide. Nonetheless, it has endured and remains the sort of staple of Christmas. But if you kind of want to look at the cult classics or the underbelly of the Christmas films, I turn to, I suppose, the iconic one, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. From 1964, it stars a young Pia Zadora playing the role of Germa. Yes, all the characters have the word Ma at the end because they come from Mars. There's still a lot of chuckles to be had from people whenever I screen it, and it's very much that feeling of a Saturday afternoon pantomime. It still tops worst movie lists, you know, to this day, but I still rather watch that than the stop-motion Christmas specials made around that time. That was a big thing around the sort of 60s and 70s, things like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Frosty the Snowman, these stop-motion classics, which really just verged on tacky and cheesy. Now, it was not until the 70s and 80s that the horror film genre decided to get its hands on the sacred holiday of Christmas. Black Christmas came out in 1974, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Now, this is believed to have reinvigorated the slasher genre. Now, the slasher genre started with Peeping Tom and Psycho in the early 60s, but it wasn't until Black Christmas came along in 1974 that the slasher was really reinvigorated. And really, Black Christmas inspired Halloween, Friday the 13th, which then inspired all these other 80s slashers. So its power can, you know, still be seen today. But, you know, a movie where people are being stabbed in the upstairs room on Christmas or at Christmas time in a sorority house, you know, it seemed like, I don't know, the perfect sort of angle to take this movie rather than it being just a straight out Santa slaying, which they kind of, dealt with more in the 80s. Along came what I dubbed the Santa slashers. Now there's two in particular, Silent Night, Deadly Night, and the sequels, and a movie called Christmas Evil from 1980. Actually, director John Waters has said that this is his favourite festive movie, and I'll read out a quote he said here. "I wish I had kids, I'd make them watch it every year, and if they didn't like it, they'd be punished." Now, both of these 80s Santa slashers, they saw a maniac lead character don a Santa suit and go on a murderous rampage. But of course, first he must witness Mummy kissing Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe, which always seems to set off the psychos in these types of movies. So very much in this period that the formula was established. There's even a movie I stumbled on recently called Elves from 1989. Believe it or not, a young woman actually discovers that she's the focus of an evil Nazi experiment where they're actually breeding elves and taking them from the North Pole to create this race of supermen. Interesting. Whether it's a flat-out Christmas movie is debatable. Now, the horror did continue later into the decade, into the 90s, but not so much gruesomely, more so the horror of I cannot believe these movies were made. You kind of had Pee-wee Herman, who was, you know, in many ways cheesy at best, you know, doing his Christmas special in 1988. But in the 90s, Ernest decided to save Christmas, and thank God he did, because it continues to this day. Thanks, Ernest. And among the voters of a recent poll I took, Jingle All the Way, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Tim Allen's The Santa Claus series, in particular number 3, which was released in 2006, these pretty much were voted as the worst ones to end the worst Christmas movies and ones to be avoided at all costs. Why is it that Tim Allen seems to be the embodiment of the Christmas movie in the 90s? I don't know if that was a good thing. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger, he seemed to be the unlikely icon for a cinematic vehicle about the silly season. Like, really, if you're looking in that period, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas seems to be the only sort of 90s movie worthy of recommendation, and it didn't have any of these actors in it, and it was stop motion. Go figure. Now, every decade, there always seems to be efforts to make the next best Christmas movie, and they always seem to fall flat. Santa's Slay, that's S-L-A-Y, from 2005, was a Christmas black comedy, and it sounds like they're kind of using the angle of Elves and, you know, Silent Night, Deadly Night. It's a black comedy horror film, but when I see that it stars a former professional wrestler, I start to think, I don't know what this film would be like. And then I even see Shannon Doherty of 90210 fame starred in The Christmas Caper from 2007. Gee, I wonder why we haven't heard of that one. I think it's inevitable the Christmas songs, the Christmas movies, and the Christmas culture will continue growing more and more rapidly each year. It'll be interesting to see what Hollywood comes up with next. My recommendations for this part of the year? Definitely Silent Night, Deadly Night, Black Christmas, the guilty pleasure Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Enjoy your festive season. Happy viewing.
Okay, so if we're talking Christmas, and we're talking the dodgier side of Christmas, or maybe even, say, holidays in general, there is one particular TV special that's ranked right up there as one of the worst tie-ins ever seen. In fact, it is said that one of the major players behind this particular holiday special tried to buy up every master copy of this to ensure that it was never screened again. We'll get back to him in a minute, but really, if we're talking bad holiday special, bad Christmas stuff, then the Star Wars holiday special from 1978 is the one that's way, way up there. To give you a little bit of context, I did try to watch this a little while ago with my son, who is an even bigger Star Wars fan than I am. He lasted 10 minutes before going, with very sincere eyes, "Dad, can we turn this off now, please?" And who today told me that the Star Wars Holiday Special is, and I quote, "terrible, horrible." So, from someone who is a Star Wars fan and also agrees very much with his son, I can tell you straight up, this is not a redeeming features. We're just going to go full on into this. And so, from a Star Wars fan to someone who's not so much of a Star Wars fan, I'm of course joined by Christian. How are you, Christian?
Great, thank you, Trevor. Thank you for inviting me to discuss this terrible, horrible holiday special. So I think that definitely sums it up. And coming from the angle of a non-Star Wars nut, it even leaves me quite even more confused. But I do have to point out, you know, to our listeners, a couple of podcasts ago, we did through the redeeming features, I was forced to watch the entire Phantom Menace movie. So it is interesting that the two encounters that I've had in its entirety with Star Wars have to be the two worst features of the canon. Even though, you know, lumping the holiday special in as a movie is probably not correct, and probably even comparing it with Phantom Menace is a bit weird. But I'm definitely still coming at it with, you know, scratching my head, not knowing much about the universe. But from the sounds of it, fans scratch their heads too.
It really mystifies a lot of people. I've got to admit, though, I really did want to, I suppose, share the experience of having to watch the entire thing all the way through. I'd only seen bits and pieces up until very, very recently, and I was trying to get family and friends to also watch it just so I wouldn't have to suffer alone, and I got a lot of just outright flat refusal. So I do appreciate you watching this, Christian. I really, really do.
Oh, no worries, Trevor. It's a 70s bad movie or bad special. I'm right into it. But mentioning the word special, I noticed straight into it. It has that 70s variety TV show. Very much, not that I can think offhand of examples, or maybe, I don't know, the Sonny and Cher show. Heaps of shows in the 70s where it's very much based on this kind of structure where it was very much all these sort of vaudeville type acts or kind of cameos by famous people in between all these comedy skits and sketches. And that's very much how the special sort of sums up in it. And I think the only way to kind of get through it, and I kind of looked at it like this, was to constantly remind yourself you're watching a TV special. This isn't a movie. It's not supposed to be consistent or have a coherent plot. But yeah, definitely, it just had 70s TV show written all over it. And very much, too, I felt a lot of the influence of disco on the special. It may have been, you know, a lot of the musical numbers, but yeah, it definitely was something right straight out of 1978 and possibly didn't belong anywhere near the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, it was a Star Wars themed variety show with just a slightest sliver of a plot to sort of link it all together.
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, sort of dissecting, that whole variety show mode, you know, as soon as the opening credits start, it's got the Star Wars Holiday Special starring Jefferson Starship, almost waiting for an applause. You know, it was just so over the top and really just didn't fit the Star Wars canon at all. And I think, you know, to be honest, launching straight into the movie with the first 10 minutes pretty much having no dialogue whatsoever, you're almost guaranteed to lose your viewership.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically from the Star Wars Holiday Special and just a tiny bit of setup with Han Solo and Chewie trying to get home to Chewbacca's family to celebrate Wookiee Life Day. Let that sink in for a moment. It then goes to Chewbacca's family, and yes, there is over 10 minutes of nothing but Wookiee speak. No subtitles, no other dialogue, just a series of...
And the whole... Well, let's just say the whole time I was watching it, I was thinking, is it supposed to be subtitles? And you're just kind of making, you're trying to make sense of what's happening. And really, as I said, you would have lost the audience straight away because the first 10 minutes of any sort of material is when you get your audience in and they've just done the total opposite. And I know they're trying to, you know, come up with a plot, but really they shouldn't have had the plot rotate around Chewbacca and his family, who don't talk. That was a 101 mistake.
And then, oh, to break it up, they did have that holographic acrobat segment. I just wish the music behind that was also an illusion that I could just ignore, but that was certainly an interesting stylized version from the Wookiees, I suppose, at least for a couple of minutes.
Oh, definitely. It just felt like the poor man Cirque du Soleil, didn't it? But I don't know if it was just me, but I swear the person wearing playing Chewbacca's wife was played by a man. Just the body language, I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest. But they are some interesting characters, and you know, you mentioned the hologram for what's his name? Is it Lumpy, the little boy?
Lumpy, oh God, yeah. Lumpy. He is such an annoying little bit of smelly brown stuff.
I know, he kind of looks like some really bad furball. he seemed to spend the whole thing sort of being the annoying kid. I'm sure if he talked, he'd just be constantly, Mom, Mom, pulling on her apron. It just seemed like that really annoying sort of character. And it's almost like they were trying to make out him to be kind of the hero of the piece. And it's just sort of, oh, you know, it just didn't sort of, it just felt quite flat. But then later on, you've got the grandfather who's called Itchy, I believe, who gets his own sort of, he doesn't get a hologram this time. Instead, he gets what I think is Wookiee porn, possibly, in the form of a disco diva, Diane Carroll. Now, this is quite a strange scene. I have, you know, in recent years read about that scene again, having not seen the movie for a while, and then saying about the Itchy porn scene, I'm like, oh, from memory, it was just a woman singing. But no. The dialogue literally involves, I'm saying to Itchy, oh, you'll really like this, wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, and, yeah, it got to be quite strange, to be honest.
Yeah,
and
I
just went on and on.
I did find that very disturbing. It's like, hang on, so Wookiee is like humanoid porn, and he's right there in the family room with everybody else. I mean, I just didn't know where that was going to go, and I just wanted it to go away as fast as possible.
Well, the guy brings over these gifts for them, and he gives, you know, gives Chewbacca's wife a TV or a radio, whatever it was, and then what does Grandpa get? Some disco porn.
Go, Grandpa.
but like all of the numbers in this show, they just seem to go on for ages. And, you know, I must admit, I'm a fan of Jefferson Starship or Airplane or Starship. They've been on so many incarnations. I know them more sort of the 60s sort of stuff, but this was one of their incarnations, and that song just seemed to go on for ages. It was so drenched in disco. And believe it or not, it was actually released as a 7-inch single in 1978. And it's interesting, I've seen the cover, and it's got, you know, light up my life, or whatever the name of the song is, you know, as featured on the Star Wars Holiday Special. And I'm like, ooh, that's a connection you wouldn't want to have.
No, holographics are bad.
I was just going to say, and I googled it, and the single did very badly, so possibly the special was responsible. Sorry, continue.
All we can say is bad holographic Jefferson Starship.
Oh, bad. Oh, bad. But it just seemed to match all the other sort of scenes. You had the holographic dances, the Diane Carroll disco porn, and then this sort of scene, and it just seemed to be slotted in, and it was these sort of things joined together by this very, as you said, loose or slight plot. That was quite strange. But a question that I've kind of got written here to ask you was, does this really advance the plot in any way, aside from the Boba Fett or Boba Fett section, which we'll talk about? You know, that's what I was interested to know, because there was a couple of shots there where they kind of cut it in what looked like scenes from the original movies. I don't know. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, well, yeah, all the actual action and, I suppose, bigger scenes, it's very brief snippets from the original movie, I guess, to throw in a bit of actual Star Wars action. There is the suggestion that for the first Star Wars movie, George Lucas was actually considering including a section with Chewbacca's family, which he ended up not using, and from that, the holiday special came out. But again, as we mentioned, after the fact, George Lucas wanted to basically destroy this thing, wipe it from existence, make sure it never got seen again, and actually actively denied it existing for quite some time.
Oh, you know, like we've even tried cheekily to try and get the rights to screen it. It's always reached back with, you know, if any cinema's found screening this, we'll burn it down or something to that effect. So I'm like, okay, I'll stay away. Let's keep it to watch at home. But even that's excruciating. Or it's definitely, I even thought, oh, could it be a sort of game, a movie that you'd watch with a group of friends sort of in a party mode. But I'm like, nah, what a way to kill the mood.
Definitely. Actually, George Lucas was quoted at a convention once. So essentially, the only reason that this is still watchable and around now was because of an ongoing underground bootleg video scene, which saw copies passed from person to person over a number of decades now. Of course, now it's all digitized and electronic, so getting a copy is a lot easier than it used to be. But yeah, at a convention, George Lucas, when asked about what he thought about the whole bootleg video situation, was that if he could, he would, if he had the time and a sledgehammer, he would track down every bootleg copy and smash it.
That's a guy determined to sweep something under the rug.
Absolutely.
I can understand, look, not even being a Star Wars fan, I look at it and go, oh my God, what a way to almost destroy this branding, this something that had been established so much in the first movie. But I can understand from a marketing point of view that they've just rushed this in to capitalize on all the sort of, the hype and the phenomenon that had surrounded the first movie. So, but then for this to come out, I'm almost surprised, and I don't know if anything happened, but I'm surprised that the TV special didn't almost, kill the subsequent movies. I assume it was screened and never spoken of again.
Pretty much. And, when you're mentioning marketing as well, I was going to bring it up a bit later on, but they've been broached now. The version that I had included a lot of the original ads as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which were quite painful. But, like, towards the end, there was quite a big ad for Star Wars merchandise, the figures and the playsets and the remote control R2-D2. So it was, and the fact that that was featured so prominently towards the end of the special, I think that was definitely intended to tie in and obviously push that merchandise. Considering Star Wars is basically what invented that type of merchandise for movies.
But it's interesting because, as I said earlier, they would have lost a lot of the audience so early on because it's just so hard to sort of get into the movie. They really should have put a lot more of their merchandising at the start, and there's not really too much at the start. It's interesting. I noticed, you know, the version I had a few ads too, actually more than I'd seen before. And there was quite a lot of merchandising ads towards the end, and I was surprised. But they're probably like, oh, we better get some in last minute for those last five people that are watching. But I don't know, having now gone back and sort of like I'd seen it once before and sort of got all the way through it somehow, I had forgotten a lot of it, but. And I had seen a lot of scenes over the years. I'd only ever seem to have got sort of the first 20 minutes, half an hour into it, which is, obvious given the film itself or the special. But I found that it actually, the later scenes were a lot more tolerable. I don't know, maybe I was more susceptible to this being a bad special by then. But I think maybe too, there were scenes I hadn't seen a lot of. And there was talking, there was no Wookiees. So I think that makes it a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, anyway, back to the special itself. We could talk around the special for ages, and I can imagine that most people probably would want to talk around the special rather than actually dive into it. But damn it, that's what we're here to do. I did also find it quite interesting that the Wookiee home, the house, it did have a very 70s suburban aesthetic, didn't it, with the wood panel furnishing and the oven. It was this galaxy far, far away that was still stuck in the 70s.
Oh, I've read a review that said it looked like a 70s ski lodge, and I agree so much with that. And then you've got those awkward scenes when Lumpy's like trying to balance on the wall or the beams outside, and it was just such you know, really bad green screen, you think, oh, shame on you with the, you know, with the technology that we were able to see from George Lucas, and the sort of, you know, some of the stuff was just quite tacky.
I like the hand-drawn shots of the external of the house.
It's just so
obviously hand-drawn.
And just imagine how clear that would have, because, you know, obviously the copies we're watching nowadays are very second or third generation, but you wonder what it would have looked like watching that on TV. Blatantly obvious, especially in comparison to having just seen the blockbuster. But, hey, that would have been just seen on the big screen. So this was definitely designed for a small screen, possibly proving that Star Wars doesn't belong on a small screen at all, maybe. But yeah, interesting is the whole Boba Fett section. Now, I have heard that in recent times when they've released the Blu-rays of the original movies and included a lot of special features, apparently this is the only section of the holiday special which is actually included anywhere on Blu-ray, acknowledged by Lucasfilm. I think that's right, isn't it?
Yeah. Aside from the fact that it was very poorly animated, and I still have no idea what they were thinking when they drew Han Solo's face towards the end there. His face looks like a foot.
Oh, it looks terrible, yeah.
But apparently it was. It was like the section that got the most positive response. So people were still watching at that point. And the fact that it got such a good response, and the character of Boba Fett got such a good response, it's rumored that that's why he was featured more heavily in the subsequent movies, because they just found that he was a popular character.
So that's interesting, but I don't know if it was just the fact that we're watching it through, you know, a really bad quality version, but it just seemed to take the special straight to Saturday morning TV land as soon as that special started. But it sounds like, you know, that's what it almost needed. The special almost needed it. It would have definitely risen back up again in terms of, popularity.
Yeah.
Hit.
It certainly is the high. I think it is safe to say it is the high point. It doesn't have to go very far to be that high point, but it would be the high point of the special.
Oh, definitely. And if you were to look at if you were to map the special like a graph, you could easily say that section being pretty much near the middle is probably the high point. It, you know, slopes downhill on either side.
Yeah, the peak.
But even saying it reaches straight up to good is probably even a fast stretch.
It goes from terrible to subpar.
And mediocre would be being really, really extravagant towards it. So
that's another thing I'm wondering. So like with the cartoon and everything, why do the Wookiees only look at non-Wookiee based entertainment?
Oh, that's what I was thinking. It's quite strange, and it's almost like, you know, going again to the TV special land, it's like, how can we throw in a whole heap of cameos? Let's make them, you know, show up. This one's showing up doing cooking on a TV show. This one's, you know, in the form of a disco diva, you know, and it's just, yeah, it's strained. It's almost like that was their excuse to take it to TV special land whenever those moments occurred. But I must say, I don't know, you know, whilst, you know, 100% of the special is excruciating, I cannot stand that cooking show special section. You know the bit I mean?
Yeah. Harvey Korman.
Who I believe died not long ago, I think. So I know the name. I knew the name in relation to this, but, oh, that just verged on something that went out possibly in the 50s style-wise. It just, height of tackiness.
It was, yeah, quite a vaudeville-type segment that just went on way too long, and then later he returned as the instructional video when Lumpy's trying to build that translation device.
Oh, that's right.
And it's just excruciating.
Oh, I know. And they just seem to throw these things in, you know, trying to advance the plot in some way, but just seeming to add it. Yeah, more an excuse to give these people, you know, I'll give you 3 minutes to do your stuff, you know, and which is interesting because the sort of audiences watching this special would have been kids, and they're automatically taking it straight to vaudeville territory. Let's try and get in the mums and dads and the grandpas and by showing all these kind of, you know, very yesteryear stars. It was quite strange. And then like some of the awkward things, like in that the cooking show section, you know, I've got a quote written down here where there's one part he goes, "Oh, it's made by hand, solo," and I just went, "Oh no!"
Yeah,
they didn't just take it there.
And probably even before the disturbing Diane Carroll Wookiee porn section was at the start of that one, he picks up the mid, just goes, "Tenderloin," and it's this long phallic-shaped piece of meat. I'm going, are they seriously going there? They went there.
And I think my jaw was pretty much on the floor the entire time going, I cannot believe this exists, and I cannot believe, you know, like, I believe George Lucas kind of gave them control and he didn't really sort of have any say, but surely he would have had final word before it was submitted for broadcast.
I think the quality control committee was out to lunch when they slipped this one through.
So I think they were all asleep. Well, I have heard that Carrie Fisher was quite off her face, excuse the pun or quote, during the making of this, and you can pretty much tell, you know, she seems so glassy-eyed in most of the film, and, you know, I think that might have been her way of getting through it.
I'll tell you what, though, bring up Carrie Fisher and probably more the character Leia, one thing that really stuck out to me in this was as they finally got away from the Wookiee speech and started bringing in other characters and people to interact with. Oh, incidentally, the first of which was R2-D2. So you had Wookiee talk communicating with R2-D2. So it was before Luke finally talked. So you've got R2-D2, C-3PO, Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, the shopkeeper dude. They can all understand the Wookiee's perfectly. Now along comes Princess Leia. C-3PO has to translate for her. She can't understand them. And then she has the audacity to ask if there's anyone else there she can speak to. Bloody royal snob.
I know. It could have just been Carrie Fisher muffling her lines.
Quite possibly. And then, when they finally get to Life Day, well, more of that a bit later on, the one person who can't be asked to learn Wookiee is the one that sings the Life Day song to the tune of the Star Wars theme.
I know. So you can't really say over the course of the special that she develops at all. She doesn't seem to take on learning the language.
No.
But oh gosh. But yeah, no. But then you know, looking at it, God, I seem to have already sort of erased most of it from my memory from the other day. But the mains, you know, Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, they really, you know, the shooting of their scenes wouldn't have been too much. So I get the feeling that they wouldn't have been quite aware of what they were getting themselves in for, because what they've structured a lot of across, you know, using only a lot of, you know, not much footage, let's just say that. You know, they're not really in it very much if you think about it.
Yeah, they do kind of just come and go.
And that's probably a wise thing, because I think if they'd done more, it would have possibly tarnished the brand even more, which I'm surprised this didn't. And it may have. I don't know if it spurred any sort of merchandising, and I don't know if people would have rushed out the following day and bought any merchandise or trashed Star Wars merch. I don't know, but I definitely think this wouldn't have sold people on it.
Maybe it's the reason why Empire Strikes Back ended up being such a dark movie. They were just trying to go, look, this is a serious movie franchise. Look how nasty we're getting in the second movie.
Oh, yes, erase all memory. We're in the 80s now.
Yep.
But then you're like looking at all these sort of segments, and it's interesting because you sort of strip it back a bit and there really isn't much to the special, you know, and by the time you, like, it was me when I first saw the running time as 2 hours, I'm like, gosh, but then of course once you get through all the ads, you realize that there isn't really much to it by the time you get through 15 minutes of Wookiee and all these extended dance routines and songs and stuff. But then almost weirdly thrown at the end is that cantina scene, and I don't know if it was almost like, I'm not being aware too much of the original movie, but the cantina, does it show quite prominently in the original three movies? Like, it felt like they needed to put that scene in.
Yeah, well, the cantina on Tatooine is quite an iconic location that does feature quite a bit in the first Star Wars. I mean, that's where they meet Han Solo, in order to get off the planet and really get the adventure started. It does, if you go through like the other movies, and a lot of the spin-offs, it actually features quite prominently in the Lego Star Wars specials that are out there, which are worth a watch. If you're going to watch any Star Wars spin-offs, go for the Lego Star Wars spin-offs and not for this one.
Yeah, good idea. But so it seems like when they want it, being such an identifiable cantina or scene, they sound like they just sort of wanted to throw it into the special and almost let's take it straight into vaudeville 70s special land and have B. Arthur singing it to a whole heap of people in weird heads. And it's almost like when you really stripped it back, it was like, but when you know after the. You know, this finished, I thought to myself, was that a whole scene, you know, the Imperial Guard, I believe, shut down the cantina, and pretty much the entire scene was her initially being wooed over by some guy, and then really a whole scene about her telling them that they've been shut down and to pretty much get out.
Yeah, and to get them out, she has to sing them a song and make them form a conga line to the door.
Oh, and of course they won't, you know, she'd say, you know, hello, people, friends, or whatever, to all of them, and none of them would listen. But as soon as she starts singing, they're all conga-lining and doing everything she says. But, oh, like, I know she was a big star around the time, having done Broadway, and she'd just come off doing, I believe, got an Academy Award nomination for MAME in the late 70s. So I would have seen that's why she was connected with this special, because at the time, in the sort of theatre scene or the musical scene, she was quite hot property. But this scene just seemed quite, you know, just slotted in towards the end and almost just an excuse for a song and dance number when already they'd gone to excruciating territory. Do they need to do any more? That said, it's probably one of the more tolerable scenes, but probably because, I don't know, it just felt like a scene out of a musical to me. And I felt it quite, it was funny, B. Arthur said in an interview that she didn't actually realise until after it came out that she was actually filming something Star Wars related. She was told she was just filming a scene with all these people with strange heads and masks on. So that puts a whole new spin on it.
It does indeed. Well, she actually does. When you look at the performances and the level of performance and the quality of the acting, if I can use that word quite generously, she does actually perform her scene with enthusiasm, which I guess it does lift it above the rest of this entire experience.
Which makes you wonder, maybe not knowing it was a Star Wars thing made her have to bring in a better performance. Maybe the other people were trying too hard. Could be a way to look at it.
Yeah, I just know that the leader of the Imperial Guards, when they turn up, is an atrocious actor.
Oh, I know, of all people to get, especially in all the connections that they would have had when they were making this. I thought it was quite strange too. But now, interesting, I know we touched on it earlier, but you mentioned you've got a few more things to say about a possible Life Day song. One of the highlights or lowlights or low points of the soundtrack. Not that there's any high points, to be honest.
Yeah.
But amongst all the disco numbers, there is a very interesting song that kind of is the finale of the piece. But a lot of fans may notice that the sound of it is quite familiar. So I'll let Trevor sort of discuss that a bit more.
That's right. So when they – of course, Chewbacca does make it to join his family for Wookiee Life Day after many very brief battles with TIE fighters and the like along the way, which are all done via quick snippets of scenes from the original Star Wars movie. And then they all go off and they join together and they lift up their sparkly baubles, which then let them walk through space. And I'm wondering, hang on, if they can walk through space, why was it such a problem to get to the Wookiee home planet in the first place?
Mm.
And they all gather around this big tree where C-3PO and R2-D2 are already waiting. No idea how they got there, and then the rest of the main characters come out. And as mentioned, Princess Leia comes out and does a little speech. to the Wookiees, even though she can't understand them. Again, royalty, eh. And sings this very sincere song about life and love to the main Star Wars theme. Probably not much more you can really say about that. It's goes on too long. It's quite uninspiring, and you're meant to be taking it all seriously. And
And I think that was probably the big scene where, to me, you really noticed that Carrie Fisher just seems so damn out of it.
Yeah. Well, hang on, I've found some of the lyrics.
Oh, gosh.
I won't do it to the Star Wars theme, but just imagine a day that takes us through the darkness, a day that leads us into light. Light, a day that we celebrate the light.
Oh, it's such inspiring lyrics, aren't they? Wow. Now, why wasn't that released as a single?
Oh, it should have been. And then afterwards, and after a bit more touching family reunion Wookiee speak, they then give us a whole pile of flashbacks to the original movie, just so you can be reminded how much better it was in the tripe you just sat through.
Oh, exactly. And it's almost like, you know, it was too little too late. You know, they were trying to redeem themselves in the last little bit and it just sort of, it failed. But, it was interesting. It just sort of ended and I was very much like, okay, wow, that exists. But, yeah.
But it, I don't often say this after he went back and added all the extra bits to the original movies with CGI that just clashes horribly with the original print. But this is one thing where I can say I think I'm on George Lucas's side. If he had have got his wish and managed to sledgehammer this out of existence, I don't really think that would be much of a negative impact on the heritage of Star Wars.
Oh, definitely. You know, and you know, there's even an official website, you know, and they put a lot of news, and there's been petitions to get Lucasfilm to, you know, will they ever release it on DVD or anything like that. But, you know, based on, you know, the way he's spoken, you know, I doubt anything will ever happen, and I think possibly it will once he dies, but then I think the estate, you know, incorporating Lucasfilm would just make sure that's just swept under the rug forever. It's almost like, you know, one of those bad movies that an actor makes, you know, before they're famous, that they wish no one had ever thought of or is ever going to see. So I can understand, and it really is bad, but for me, it's got cult oddity written all over it. As to someone who's quite interested in the 70s and kind of pop culture, it's an interesting piece to look at, let's just say that, but it's not something you'd go out of your way to watch on a regular basis.
Indeed. Oh, it's just still shaking my head. I do think it mentally scarred me.
Oh, especially if you're a fan too, because it would have just been like taking, you know, I could imagine, you know, one of my favourite things if they took the characters out of that world and, you know, still keeping it in that world, but, you know, almost turned it upside down and almost exploited it in a totally different form, which is exactly what they've done. You know, I could imagine being quite distraught by it. But, I'm just so glad that it wasn't a redeeming feature, because to be honest, I believe that my page would be blank.
Yep, it would not be redeemable, basically.
Exactly.
It is terrible and bad and horrible. If you must see it, well, it's never been officially released for sale, so I guess the questionability of how you can acquire this is in a big grey area. So I'm not going to go into how you would do that. I guess I'm not going to take that step, but I'm pretty sure there's plenty of people out there with the knowledge of how to get their hands on this special. Again, like I said, if you really must see it, and I don't recommend it.
Even though it's not a redeeming feature, it'd be quite interesting to sort of compare it to, you know, the redeeming features that we've had this year. And even though it's not a movie and it's a special, would you say it's down there with Blood Rain?
Blood Rain still is rather special. When I talk to people of Blood Rain, and I have a few times, I don't know why, I can see their eyes light up as I talk about it, and I can see that they're thinking, I have to see this, and then I've just really got to stress how terrible it is.
Oh, look, I'm writing it down as we speak, because I really do need to finally. Look, I still haven't been convinced to watch, but I think I might actually. I have to see this.
Don't do it.
You've spoken about it so many times.
Don't do it, Christian, please.
Oh, no.
Don't
not even
do
worth
it.
Buying. Oh, gosh. But yeah, now if it's on a par with the holiday special, I think that one's best slipped on the rug as well.
Yep. So any listeners out there, if you have any comments on the Star Wars Holiday Special, maybe you are a fan. I can't imagine it, and I probably would recommend you seek professional help, but you might be out there. Let us know. Of course, we want to hear your thoughts, and yeah, it would be interesting to find out what other people took from this Star Wars Holiday Special. Yeah.
Very interested to see. So thanks very much. Look forward to hearing people's thoughts or their thoughts on not wanting to see it.
Yep, that would work too. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Christian.
Thank you, Trevor, and thank you, listeners.
Watch out.
You better not cry.
You better not call on yours, Jedi.
The Empire is coming to town.
Thank you so much for listening to this very special episode of The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Now, we are going to take a short break over the Christmas New Year period, so you'll have to wait until the 9th of January for our triumphant return in the new year. In the meantime, though, please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. Simply find The Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Ustream. Head to therufusproject.podomatic.com and leave us a message. Maybe you want to review us on iTunes. I'm sure this is probably one of the better Christmas specials out there, if I do say so myself. Or if you're still looking for that ideal last-minute gift solution, which probably won't turn up before Christmas, so you have the joy of saying, I've got you something, it's on its way, trust me, head to our Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. Trust me, it will be the most unique gift you can probably get someone, particularly if they've never even heard of us. Wouldn't that be fun? Also, we are gearing up a number of interviews so we can start next year very, very strong. So if you are someone or have an event or even know someone that you think would be suitable for featuring in our local wildlife section, then definitely let us know. You can contact us on any of the previous mentioned methods, or send us an email to rufusreviews@gmail.com. And of course, on the internet, we are all local. You can be from Brisbane, you can be from Melbourne, you can be from anywhere in Australia or anywhere in the world. We would love to talk to you. So until next time, yes, I am going to have to finish sincere. Have a great and safe Christmas and New Year. We are very much looking forward to seeing you in the new year. Have a good one.
Boom, 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 boom,
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, a 54 convertible to light blue.
If you don't know where that slight variation of our opening music came from, you might be interested in knowing that Christopher Lee, yes, that Christopher Lee, Count Dracula in the Hammer horror films, Saruman in the Lord of the Rings film, the guy that played Count Dooku in the Star Wars prequel trilogy films, released a heavy metal Christmas single. It had the Little Drummer Boy and Silent Night in full metal style. Really, you've got to respect this guy.